Life can feel overwhelming, but you don't have to go through it alone. On my podcast, From the Heart with Rachel Braithen, I share openly and vulnerably about everything life brings us and what we can learn by living with our hearts a little bit more open. Every Friday, a new episode brings you a new story with topics on self-care, motherhood, healing, and more. You are enough, just the way you are. This podcast is a reminder of that. Follow and listen to From the Heart with Rachel Braithen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Connection, a weekly radio program where we share our experiences and expertise with stories of caring, courage, and change right here in Connecticut. Listen to learn about needed resources to improve your well-being and transform your life. Now, here are the hosts of The Connection, Lisa DeMattis-Lepore and Ann Baldwin.
And welcome to another edition of The Connection right here on WTIC News Talk 1080. I'm Ann Baldwin.
And I'm Lisa DeMattis-Lepore. It's wonderful to see you this morning, Ann.
You as well. And we should mention that Lisa is the president and CEO of The Connection. And we talk each and every week about different topics. And one of the things that we're talking about today, and there's so much to talk about, this is like an encore presentation of Dr. Kathleen Maurer, who's the medical director for the Department of Correction. And Dr. Maurer, you're a medical physician, you studied at Yale. I mean, I'm just going to let you, because you do it so nicely, let's let the folks out there know that you got some street cred.
So I am a physician, went to medical school at Yale, trained at the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas, which is a Parkland-affiliated hospital. Then I came back to Yale for fellowship training in occupational and environmental medicine. I'm board certified in that field, in internal medicine and in addiction medicine. And I have an MBA, an MD, and an MPH.
Amazing.
Wow. It is amazing. Can I ask you a question? Why the addiction medicine? I mean, that's kind of a new field, right? That's got to be one of your newer degrees?
Yeah. So actually, when I went to work at the Department of Correction, I didn't know a lot about corrections at that time, and I started learning, and I have this like desire to try to solve problems. And I realized that a lot of the people in our system had substance use disorders, and that was, you know, we wring our hands about recidivism. How, what are we going to do about recidivism? These people keep coming back. Well, first of all, let's look at why. Many come back because of substance use disorders. So along the way, I was given responsibility for the addiction services group at the Department of Correction, and I said, well, you know what? If I'm going to be responsible for this large group of people and our treatment of them, I have to know what I'm talking about. So I studied and got boarded in addiction medicine.
Wow. So Lisa, how does The Connection and the Department of Correction, how do your lives collide? Or should I say blend?
They blend. So it's a really wonderful partnership that we have with the Department of Correction. We are funded by the Department of Correction to run several programs. And I must say that I think the Department of Correction has become more and more sophisticated. They really have a high quality level of the staff that work there. They're very passionate. They're very knowledgeable. We've really enjoyed working with the Department of Correction, and I do, when I say partnership, I think that's really key, because we really come together to understand and work together on clients. And the treatment is individualized, and I think what I really love about the Department of Correction is the ability to give folks a call and to talk about a case and to figure out how we're going to make things work and if we have any issues, etc. But we're very lucky, like I said, to, of course, work with DOC, but most importantly, to have someone like Dr. Maurer at the helm. So it's really, it's a great opportunity for the staff and for the work that we believe in.
You know, Dr. Maurer, we had an individual on this program a while back who ended up in Hartford County and then in the prison system here in Connecticut for multiple DUIs. And he talked about his experience and people that were coming down off of heroin and other drugs and how they were just dope sick and violently ill. Is that still happening? And is part of your initiative, you know, under your watch to kind of eliminate or try to alleviate some of that?
Yeah, so there are formal medical protocols for what is commonly referred as detox. I call that medically managed withdrawal. So we have formal protocols for managing withdrawal using opiate agonist therapy, and we use those for patients. So that should be a thing of the past.
You know, and it's interesting because I learned this from my own personal experience with alcohol, and that when I went to a detox and when the interventionist put me on the airplane, he fed me vodka the whole flight. I was like, I could get used to this. But, you know, all joking aside, it was so that I didn't seize out, because as a medical doctor, you know, you can't, even with alcohol, I think some people say it's even more serious if you just stop it than it is some of these other drugs. It'll kill you.
Yeah, alcohol withdrawal is worse than heroin withdrawal from the perspective of the risk for death. Alcohol withdrawal can lead to death. Heroin doesn't usually. Sometimes people die in heroin withdrawal, but that's mostly because they're dehydrated, they're throwing up, they're having diarrhea, and they don't have adequate fluid resuscitation. Alcohol is different. It's very, alcohol withdrawal can lead to death. You have to be very cautious caring for these patients.
Can you talk to us about the latest topic that I see everywhere, every news clipping, on the radio, et cetera, about the quote-unquote opioid crisis?
Yeah, so in not just Connecticut, but across
the
country.
Of course, it's across the country,
yeah,
yes.
The opioid epidemic is horrible. I call it a plague. It's ravaging our country. I spoke not too long ago at the American Correctional Association. I had a room of about 150 people, and I said, how many people here have not been touched by the opioid epidemic? And, like, nobody raised their hands.
Right.
This is a horrendous thing that's happening to us in our own state. So the other thing that I really believe strongly is that corrections organizations across the country at all levels, the jail side, the prison side, reentry, mm-hmm. have a huge role to play in resolving this problem. And why do I say that? Because 52% of the people who died of an accidental overdose in Connecticut in 2016, that's slightly more than half, had at one time been in our system, in the Department of Correction.
So that's about, is that about 500 people?
It's actually 400 and something.
Okay, and it was close to 500.
Yeah, yeah. It's between 450 and 500. Mm-hmm. But think about it. Mm. We have these people in our... you know, we have them incarcerated. We have the ability to treat these
What an
people.
Opportunity.
That's right. What an opportunity. And it's not just us. Mm-hmm. It's all around the country, right? This
right.
is the data looks just like this and higher than this in Rhode Island. This is all around the country. So I have to say, I'm going to say a little bit about what we're doing nationally. I'm part of the American Correctional Association, which is the largest correctional professional society in the country. And at our last meeting, I've been talking about MAT at our meetings for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years.
And MAT is medicated assisted treatment.
Yes, okay. Yes, using medication along with psychosocial counseling to treat opioid use disorder especially. So in August in St. Louis, the three governing bodies of the American Correctional Association, it's a mostly custody-focused organization, and it's the largest in the world, passed a resolution supporting the implementation of MAT, medication-assisted treatment, in corrections, at all parts of corrections, all along the criminal justice continuum, from the, you know, even community policing to arrest, to jails, to prisons, to reentry. I mean, this represents a huge change.
Wow.
A huge change in the approach of corrections to the treatment of people, our people.
And what kind of difference is it going to make? I mean, what is your hope with that? Because, you know, Lisa asked you, what about this opioid epidemic? This is it. So what is your hope with this new change of philosophy, if you will, and treatment?
So if we're treating people coming out of our system and treating people when they come in, not taking them off their methadone, for example, putting them on an opiate agonist or opiate antagonist when they leave, either leave jail or leave prison, their risk for overdose is markedly decreased. Markedly decreased. It's not zero, but it's markedly decreased. So we can we can change these statistics. We can start moving this horrible problem down rather than up.
That's just astonishing. I when Dr. Maurer presented at our conference recently, I had seen these numbers, but I also have attended a couple of other symposiums on the plague of opioid addiction and numbers across the United States, and I know that it's close to the 1,000 number just because they were talking about it. But it was also interesting just to hear parents were telling stories of their children that died. They had five mothers that attended this one symposium at Yale Law School, and everyone, four out of the five, these were young boys that died by 21. They all were excellent in school. They all came from maybe one family. There was a divorce, but I say that because people try to associate, well, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. All sports-minded. And all of those four that had passed, call a coincidence, you're the expert, Dr. Maurer, I'm not, they were hurt, they were injured at a young age playing sports and were put on a drug that they became then addicted to that started their addiction.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of that, right? And there's a lot of effort now being put into the training for physicians, both training in medical schools,
yes,
and training in the community, because we relicense every year. Mm-hmm. We have to update our licenses every year, and there are continuing medical education criteria for doing that. And now there's a lot of effort being put into training physicians to be very judicious about the use of opioids treatment. Yeah.
And I can tell you that is happening. But, you know, again, to play devil's advocate a little bit, why does a pendulum always have to swing, you know, from one extreme to the other? You know, I just had lunch with a friend of mine who needs double knee replacement surgery and has a torn rotator cuff, a grown man, you know, in his, like, 60s. And he's like, I can't get any painkillers. They just won't give me any, you know, because of this whole opioid thing is what he blamed it on. So why is it, though, that the pendulum has to go from one extreme to the other? There are people out there who seriously do need those pain meds, but then you listen to Lisa talk about these young boys. It's like, from my opinion, when I went back to Colorado, people smoking pot, don't tell me, Ann, that that's not a gateway drug. One thing leads to another, leads to another. It's like the kid that wants to ride the Ferris wheel and they end up on the fastest roller coaster because it just gets more and more exciting. That's my editorial comment.
Also, I just want to clarify that that was no criticism to the MDs that are pretty amazing out there that are taking care of patients. But it was just stunning to me, to hear that story, and it was just really heartbreaking. The message really at the Yale Symposium about that opioid crisis was that it was poignant for this reason, because they were all Caucasian. I need to say this. They were all Caucasian and upper, middle to upper class. And folks in that symposium were silent, because I think, again, when people think about certain populations or addictions, they think it's minority. They think it's this population. They think it's this. It is absolutely, completely untrue. I've seen it. I know you've seen it. It affects everyone. It is not prejudice. Addiction is not a prejudice.
No, it's an equal opportunity
disease.
Yes, it is. Yeah, there's no question.
I don't mean to giggle. Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Dr. Kathleen Maurer, Medical Director for Department of Correction. You know, one of the big burning questions, and you had it in your presentation that you presented at the Connections conference, is, you know, why do people use opioids? Why do they start? What's in it for them?
So most people, actually, if you talk to people, a lot of them don't start because they want to be addicts.
Right.
I don't think you can have anybody tell you, oh, I did this because I had in my mm-hmm. one of my life goals, one on my bucket list, to be an addict, right?
Yeah. True.
People start by parties with teenage kids and taking pills. They start with an injury.
Right.
Many, you know, what Lisa says is really very true. I see this many times as people get injured. They get a narcotic pain medicine. Mm-hmm. They realize that it's a really nice thing to have. And they keep using it and using it. They want more and more. They use it before their scripts are done. Finally, their doctors say no. And then they're looking for something to relieve the cravings and relieve the withdrawal, and they go to heroin. I mean, that's a kind of a, and I'm sure that that's what you heard those folks in New Haven.
I did. It was heartbreaking. I did.
It is heartbreaking. It's awful. You know, in my profession, right? My profession is responsible for a lot of this. But there are a lot. So people don't choose to be addicts. And I think different people come to addiction in different ways. There are different pathways. But everybody, when they get to that addiction end, really need care, really need treatment, really need understanding.
And we've seen many clients also, not necessarily started at teenage, but those that, you know, became addicted older, you know, older in their life from accidents on the job, carpenter, you know, again, I'm not stereotyping, but folks that got injured in some way, whether it was recreationally or whether it was on the job, and they started, you know, taking pain meds and, you know, lost everything and, you know, were trying to rebuild their lives again.
You know, and that you bring up a point that hits home for me, because for me, my alcoholism didn't hit me hard until I was 50. So you just never know. I mean, was I an alcoholic all my life? I don't know. I mean, I got married, had a great job, I raised kids. If I was functional. I mean, I'm pretty aware of what I've done. But it wasn't until I hit 50 that something clicked in my disease, and it just went on, the faucet was opened and it couldn't be shut off. You know, so that's the other point here. You never know when it's going to hit you. You see people later in life. I mean, I see it in the rooms. I see people in their teens. I see people in their 80s. You know, you just never know. There's no rhyme or reason. There is no stereotype. And if we look at the news, and if unfortunately you read the obituaries, look at the faces of those young people that are dying.
I know.
That's who's dying. That's what's happening. So one of the things I want to ask you about, Lisa, too, while we have Dr. Maurer here is, maybe someone out there listening doesn't have someone who's incarcerated right now, but has someone who has an issue. Mm-hmm. Where can they go? At The Connection, you've got so many services, but you talk about partnering just like you do with Department of Correction,
yes,
with other social service agencies. Where can someone out there access information if you think somebody's got a problem? Chances are, doctor, right? They probably do.
So we encourage for listeners, if you have a question, whether it's personally related to yourself or a loved one, that you contact us at our website, which is theconnectioninc.org, theconnectioninc.org. And we also have our toll-free helpline, which is 855-435-7955. And we will direct you and assist you and or your loved one in helping you find treatment. And once again, you know, certainly if you can look at our website, do that. But I just want folks out there to understand that if we don't have a service that you or your loved one need, we will hook you up in Connecticut with one of the other agencies, of course, because we don't treat everything, obviously.
Right. I mean, you know, and that's just it. That's what's so unique about Connecticut, too, is that there's, you know, different agencies with different areas of expertise, and that's what we need. You know, it's like my business. I'm a public relations firm, but I don't do certain things. I'm not one-stop shopping, and nobody should be.
No.
Can I tell you one thing about, so methadone is an extremely highly regulated medicine in our society. DEA regulates it in our state. DMIS is involved, Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and the Department of Public Health. Methadone is dispensed in this state and all across the country by opiate treatment programs, OTPs. So if that's something that you think you need, Lisa at The Connection can connect you, or you can Google opiate treatment provider in the state, and you can see there are a number of OTPs in the state that have same-day intake. So you walk in, and usually between like 8 and 2, and they will see you that day and actually start you on medicine.
Who pays for that? Does it cost?
Medicaid, it certainly pays for methadone treatment. I think the private providers, it varies some. You might know better than I do on that. But all of these opiate treatment programs also have, they have sliding scales.
Right.
So I've never seen people, besides organizations like The Connection, I've never seen people who are so committed to patient care as the opiate treatment program providers. They have sliding scales. They sometimes treat for free.
Right.
I mean, they are remarkable. And you just Google it and you can see those providers.
And I also know, too, that a friend of mine, is having an issue with one of her loved ones who they're concerned that, you know, this young girl may be addicted, right? And so, anyway, she called exactly what you're talking about, one of these treatment facilities, and was able to get Narcan, you know, Narcan kit, so that the family has it, and they're also going to teach the family how to use it. And also, there are pharmacies that are willing to do that. You call the pharmacy, you talk to them. They've been pretty amazing in response time to our families and teaching them how to administer it.
Yeah, and I know emergency EMS, right. We work with Glastonbury EMS, they carry it now too. So that brings up something else you wanted to mention.
Yeah, let me just say that's a really excellent point. Anybody who has a family member or a relative or a acquaintance who might have an opioid addiction really should have naloxone.
Absolutely.
In their homes. They should have it and they should know how to use it. So where do you get it? Lisa's absolutely right. Most of the pharmacies, the chain pharmacies around the state, mm-hmm. you walk up to the pharmacist, they spend some time teaching you how to use it, and insurance pays for it, typically.
Right.
And I think Medicaid does too.
Medicaid pays for it.
And so, how many lives have we heard of?
Do you know how many we've saved in Connection?
How many?
I don't even know how many. There's so many. I don't really have the number, but it's administered. All of our staff are trained. I want to be trained because I'm thinking if I'm in a program and I'm walking through, and I'm requiring that everyone at our main office learns how to be trained. We do in-house training. We do it on a regular basis. All new staff have to be trained. We have the kits. In fact, our staff are carrying it around on their keychain.
You learn CPR. And you save lives. Why? And this is the new CPR, I guess.
We have saved, just over the last month, I know for a fact, 3.
Wow.
So I'm actually involved with the state police Narcan program. The state police, the troopers all carry it. Excuse me. And they are, the state troopers are the first responders in
right.
a lot of the state. And, excuse me, and we've saved, I think that program has been running almost 3 years, and that program has saved, I think, close to 190 people's lives.
Wow.
It's somewhat less than 200, but it's between like 190 and 200. So these naloxone, is, you know, so the state troopers will say, Doc, it's magic. I say, well, you know what? At least you have it, and you're reviving these people. But it is kind of magic, right? It pushes the drug off the receptors, and people wake up.
Exactly.
And then it's what you do with that person after they wake up. You know, I, like I said, we work with some emergency medical folks who say, you know, unfortunately, they revived people, and they go right back out and do it again, sometimes with the needle still in their arm. So, you know, it's like,
can I talk to you about that?
Yeah, please do.
So this state has a very creative emergency department director named Dr. Gail D'Onofrio in New Haven at Yale. They did a project where they showed that people like that who come into the emergency department can be started on buprenorphine, so Suboxone, buprenorphine, naloxone, and something like 70% of them were still on Suboxone after a month in the community.
Wow.
Right? So DEMAS, who's like a remarkable agency,
yes, they are.
Funded a number of EDs around the state to do that same thing. And that program, those programs are just getting off the ground in the last couple of months. But this, I have to say,
that's
that there
fantastic.
Are some remarkable people in this state.
Yes,
remarkable
there are.
Agencies,
yes.
Remarkable leadership, people like The Connection, remarkable providers. So this is a problem with not getting appropriate access to care. Once you've told us, hey, I'm an opioid addict and I almost died,
mm-hmm.
I need care.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately,
right? Yeah.
Right then.
Exactly.
Right. And there's a lot of programs now that are going into the emergency room departments. You've got, you know, addiction counselors and things, you know, that are bringing those folks in there, the first line of defense. And, you know, sometimes, I know in my life, you almost need the crap scared out of you. And if you can feel better, like once I detox, I'm like, okay, I can be better again. And maybe that's what's happened with some of the Suboxone and those kinds of things. People say, you know, you get that sense of normalcy again, and it feels good. It feels good. I didn't want to go back to the sickness that I felt and the way that I looked and my hair falling out and 98 pounds. I didn't want to go. That wasn't attractive. But you know what? I was in the rat cage, right? I'm going around the wheel. I couldn't stop. And a lot of people are going around that wheel. But now, you know, you say it's an opioid epidemic. It is. But I think if anything good has come out of that, people are learning more. There's more access to care. There's more funding.
Responsiveness.
There's more responsiveness. So
collaboration.
Out of everything tragic, maybe comes something good, right?
And maybe less stigma. I think
that's important.
Stigma is huge about this disease. And one of our real jobs in this world, if we make a difference, is to reduce the stigma associated with this disease.
Oh, it's so
well,
huge.
And why do you think I talk about my recovery? You know, I put a face and a voice on it. I'll tell people, yes, I'm in recovery. We're doing this radio show, and it wasn't an easy decision to make. But if I can show people that I'm a successful, you know, business owner, mother, grandmother, I didn't lose everything. I'm back on track and have been for a while. And if I can give hope and help and you know, anything to somebody else out there, I've done my job. So that's what we need to do, and that's what people that share your story, share your courage, strength, and hope. That's all we can do.
People get better.
They do. Can you just briefly talk about fentanyl? There's all this talk about fentanyl and exposure to fentanyl and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, so fentanyl's really scary, right?
Yeah, it is.
Fentanyl's a much more toxic opioid than heroin. It takes much less to kill you. A lot of the fentanyl fentanyl's easier to make than heroin. You can just chemically make it in a simple lab. A lot of the heroin that's coming into this country is now mixed with fentanyl. So it's not just a simple heroin overdose.
Exactly.
It's not just it's a fentanyl. And there's also a drug that's 10,000 times more potent than heroin called carfentanyl, which is, I just read a death report a couple of days ago that the substance was carfentanyl. So there, it was in New York, but not here. But this is a horrible, horrible risk for people because you don't know what's in that bag, right? You don't know.
That's exactly
it could
be
heroin. It could be all fentanyl. It could be carfentanyl mixed with these other things. It's a terrible problem. And when you try to reverse carfentanyl and fentanyl with naloxone, it's a totally different story. Mm. Heroin is in general, it's relatively easy to reverse with naloxone. With fentanyl, it's harder. With carfentanyl, it's probably almost impossible.
Hopefully we've shed some light on this subject. And again, Dr. Kathleen Maurer, the medical director from Department of Correction, thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Great conversation.
We
should do part 3 and part 4, but we'll have you back again, please.
Definitely will.
And thanks to all of you for listening to this edition of The Connection right here on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Your Mother is a rewatch podcast that looks back episode by episode at the hit TV show How I Met Your Mother. It's hosted by me, Josh Radner, along with series co-creator Craig Thomas.
In seasons 1 and 2, we were joined by Neil Patrick Harris, Kobe Smulders, Brian Cranston, Ashley Williams, Wayne Brady, Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey, Joe Manganiello, and my brilliant co-creator Carter Bays, and now we are diving into season 3.
So whether it's your 50th rewatch or your first time through, follow How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.